Ambry presents Next and Now, a podcast on all things genetic.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our webinar this afternoon. As many of you may know, this is the beginning of Hereditary Breast Ovarian Cancer Week and the end of Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month. And so it's a great opportunity to have a webinar on PARP inhibitors and ovarian cancer therapy. And I'm very pleased and honored to introduce our speaker for this afternoon. So Dr. Ann Catherine Goodman is the Associate Professor of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Biology at Harvard Medical School and a Fellow of the American College of Surgeons. In addition to board certification in gynecologic surgery, she is a certified in acupuncture and has completed training in both pastoral and palliative care. She is the director of the Gynecologic Oncology Fellowship Program and a member of the Ethics Committee at Massachusetts General Hospital. She's also the past president of the Obstetrical Society of Boston and of the New England Society of Gynecologic Oncologists. In addition to all of this, she is a member of the International Medical Surgical Response Team, which is a branch of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and has deployed to many different international disasters over the past 10 years. In 2012, she received the ACOG International Service Award for service to pregnant women after the Haiti earthquake. And since 2008, she's been consulting in Bangladesh on cervical cancer prevention and the development of medical infrastructure to care for women with gynecologic cancers. So with that, I am very, very pleased to let Dr. Goodman take it away.
Hi, everybody. I feel very privileged to be talking to you about PARP inhibitors and about ovarian cancer, which is one of our big struggles in the United States, different than overseas, where cervical cancer is the big struggle. And your expertise in genetic counseling and helping women and their families sort out the right path and know what their susceptibilities are, I think has revolutionized the field. So I thank you all for doing that. So this talk is going to focus on ovarian cancer. And I wanted to, first of all, say I don't have any financial disclosures. And just to say, I thought it would be useful to back up before talking about PARP and molecular pathways and just talk about ovarian cancer in general. What is it that women suffer from? How do they present? What's the histology? What's our standard of care for treatment? What's our survival rates? And then from there, move into talking about the familial ovarian cancer, BRCA, and so forth, and then go into DNA repair mechanisms and so forth, and then finish up focusing on PARP inhibitors, the mechanism of action that we understand, and then clinical trials. So in terms of our learning goals, we're going to summarize the molecular mechanism for PARP inhibitors, talk about the response rates from the clinical trials, and talk about side effects. Are there any potential complications to this new form of therapy? I always like to start thinking about the ladies we take care of, and this vignette would be a very typical presentation of a 55-year-old woman coming in with a few months history of increasing abdominal girth, the inability to eat much, lots of constipation that was preceded by probably about a year of bloating and gas and discomfort and just not feeling quite right. No particular family history. So that would be a very standard presentation. If we think about cancer in women in the United States, if we look at all sites, there's a 1 in 3 chance if you live to 90, breast being the highest, followed by lung, especially in women who smoke, and then colon, uterine, corpus. So ovarian is actually far down the list with a lifetime risk of about 1 in 70, yet it's much more fatal than all except for lung cancer. So globally, the estimations is around 200,000 women to develop the cancer, and about half of them will die of their disease. So very high case fatality rate for ovarian cancer. So in the United States, just talking about GYN malignancies, it's the second most common malignancy, but the most common cause of GYN cancer death. We estimate about 22,000 new cases a year. So it's definitely the most, not the most common cancer compared to breast, which is about 300,000. However, as I said, 16,000 plus deaths annually. There's been success stories, especially in women under 65. The mortality rates have decreased stage by stage, and I'll talk about those different stages. However, in women over 65, the mortality rates have increased. We're not totally sure why. If we think about what's the background, the epidemiology, the risk factors, it's very high in industrialized countries. It's associated with infertility. It's associated with nulliparity, not having any children. There's a subset of ovarian cancer that's associated with a very common benign condition, endometriosis. There's been studies that have looked at diet, especially dairy products, and tried to sort of correlate risk. And along with that, women who are overweight, who have obesity, have a higher risk of cancer in general, but especially hormonally driven cancers, breast cancer and ovarian cancer and uterine cancer. We definitely know that oral contraceptive use, for reasons that are not so clear, although there's lots of theories, reduce the risk. If you look at large population studies, the relative risk is really almost halved in women who are on the pill. And so women and young women, especially where we identify them as being at risk for ovarian cancer, perhaps by family history, we put them on the pill. And tubal ligation, also for reasons that aren't completely clear, seems to reduce that risk as well. Perhaps there's cutting off of blood supply, perhaps something about destroying the fallopian tubes, if that plays a role, not totally clear. So this kind of summarizes the risk factors, not being pregnant, and the theories behind that is you ovulate a lot, that causes damage to the surface epithelial lining of the ovary, perhaps something about elevated gonadotropins from your hypothalamus and pituitary in some way stimulate extra growth. And then these other factors I've listed here, early menarche, late menopause, advancing age for sure, genetics, which we'll talk about, hormone therapy, fertility drugs, and then the decreased rates, which we've talked about, breastfeeding, again, which reduces ovulation, tubal ligation, hysterectomy, of course, and taking out the ovaries is the best reduction in risk by actually removing them. If we just think about the woman I presented to you, her story is very common. And Dr. Goff, about 10 years ago, queried women who were diagnosed with ovarian cancer and compared them to age-matched control women coming in the same primary care clinic and asked what were their symptoms. And here you see listed back pain, fatigue, bloating, constipation. All these symptoms, which are very common, we all have them, but in women who ended up having ovarian cancer, they were present 30 times per month compared to women who just had the occasional bad meal and got constipated or gassy from it. And so these symptoms gave a risk odds ratio of over 7. So very significant. But the big thing is it's the frequency and the fact that it's unremitting. It doesn't go away. So those are important things. This poor woman here who's being prepared for surgery with her big belly, this is what it looks like to have ascites, abdominal distension. If you do a pelvic exam, you feel behind the uterus and there's this nodularity there. At the same time, if you look at her face, she's got wasting because she's malnourished because she can't eat because of that big belly. So that's pretty much our clinical scenario. We think about the behavior of ovarian cancer. If you see over here the uterus and the ovary sits in the cul-de-sac, and if you develop a cancer, it sheds. And then this picture over here, which was lent to me by a Japanese gynecologic oncologist, shows you the seeding and spread of cancer starting from the uterus and then going up to the liver. And this picture here with the pink and red tissue is called the omentum that's being held by by a surgeon wearing the gloves there. That's called an omental cake, and that is a very standard upper abdominal disease seen in ovarian cancer. In terms of stages, just very briefly, stage one means confined to the ovary, and then there's subsets of that. Stage two is some spread a little bit off the ovary. And stage three is either travel to lymph nodes or travel to the upper abdomen. And then the various sizes of that manifestation would be a stage 2B or stage 2C. A stage four is travel to the liver or the lungs outside of the abdominal cavity. When we think about ovarian cancer, there's many different types, especially in genetic counseling, you're really mostly confronting the risk of epithelial ovarian cancer. These other types, germ cells, sex cord, stromal, and mesenchymal, are very rare cancers that come from, in the case of germ cell, the egg and the sex cord, stromal, and mesenchymal, the fibrous tissue and the hormone-producing tissue. So we're not going to really talk about those so much. This, I thought, was a kind of neat graph that just summarized all the various types of ovarian cancer by histology. And then you see by color coding the survival rates. Red is bad, green is good. So the red is the epithelial ovarian cancer, which has a poor survival rate. And the green is things like slow, low-grade tumors, borderline tumors that have a very good five-year survival rate. And we'll talk more about the other subsets in a minute. So epithelial ovarian tumors comprise about 90% of all ovarian malignancies. This little cartoon off here shows you an ovary. Inside there's an egg with a follicle, and it's surrounded by the red hormone-producing cells. But really what we're interested in is this epithelial lining that is on the external surface. So that's where epithelial ovarian cancers arise from, and they make cysts that then, as I said, shed and travel by local extension, by lymphatic invasion, by implantation, and then by passage through the diaphragm to the lungs. The rationale for treatment, which is surgery, comes from thinking about this spread and wanting to really reduce and sterilize all areas where travel has gone to. There are, in epithelial ovarian cancer, five main histologic subtypes. Serous is the most common, and these are frequently bilateral, at least a third of the time. And they have calcium in them that sometimes you can see on x-rays. They're called seminoma bodies. Mucinous tumors are usually low malignant potential. They're very commonly unilateral, and only a small percentage of all mucinous tumors are cancerous. When they do spread, they develop a very thick mucus ascites called pseudomyxoma peritonei. The other three types, endometrioid, Brenner tumors are usually benign, and clear cell, are sort of finish up our complement of subtypes. Endometrioid are associated with endometriosis. They can be, they're usually malignant as opposed to benign forms of that. Clear cells are a very vicious kind of cancer. They're very rare. They're pretty chemo-resistant, and they probably have a very different molecular pathway than the other cancers. So to summarize how we sort of understand this, we think about ovulation. This is a diagram showing the egg where you have this ovulation. You then have this rupture to the lining that then kind of invaginates and develops a cyst. And then in some cases, especially in the setting of certain gene mutations, which we're going to talk about shortly, develop into various types of epithelial tumors, as demonstrated here, those different arrows, KRAS going to mucinous, P10 going to endometrioid, and so forth. It's important to always to nowadays think about the tubal epithelium because it's thought that at least some of the serous malignancies are actually fallopian tube cancers, and that they probably share a similar genetic destiny and a similar histology and behavior to the common high-grade serous epithelial tumors. So with that in mind, if we drill down on the machinery of the cell, what we call the regulatory pathway, this very busy slide has a wealth of information about, in a very diagrammatic and simplistic way, about the different pathways that can be disrupted that lead to disorganized cell growth and malignant change. And at the same time, using and harnessing these different pathways to disrupt the machinery in a cancer cell brings new novel therapies. And that's really very much what I think you'd say the last 10 years, and especially the last 5 years of ovarian cancer research has been about. If we sort of look at this, we see that there are receptors that are on the surface of the cell that are stimulated that lead to these pathways. You have the nuclear regulation, okay, and you have the pathways that lead to apoptosis, which is programmed cell death, all of which can be targeted in some fashion if we could understand how to do that the best. In terms of where does ovarian cancer fit in and what do we understand about that, just very generally, talking about our histologic types, in our high-grade serous, which comprise about 40% of ovarian cancer, this is the most common histology in the BRCA gene mutations. These are poor survival. They present at high stage. In terms of molecular characteristics, they have mutations in P53, and they can overexpress these other things, HER2-NU, AKT2, c-MYC. Low-grade serous are thought to be a very, very different type of disease, very favorable survival, and have a very different molecular profile with mutations in KRAS and BRAF, BRAF. This is sort of a gross and a histologic pictures for you of serous cancer. This is the big bad one, the high-grade serous cancers. And you see the sheets of cells with the cystic interior. And when you look at the growth, you see this big, complex, solid cystic mass densely adherent to the side of the uterus. Now, thinking about ovarian cancers, the majority are called sporadic. There's no obvious risk factors to them. There's no obvious family history. Their gene mutation is a mutation in the P53, which is tumor suppression. And these are usually present at advanced stage. In fact, probably about 70% of these ovarian cancers will be advanced stage, stage 3, stage 4, the majority being serous histology. And unfortunately, many of them will, if not in the beginning, will ultimately develop a chemo resistance, which I'll talk about some more as we go along. But just to back up and talk about the other histologic type, mucinous, which presents at early stage, has a mutation in KRAS, endometrioid, which is associated with endometriomas, has frequent mutations in P10 and PIK3 kinase, clear cell, which is very poor prognosis, and so forth. So here's just a picture of a mucinous carcinoma. They're usually huge. This is actually a person's arm behind there. And under the microscope is a clear cell with the classic hobnail cells. Okay, so with that as background, the standard of care is to remove surgically as much of the cancer as possible. That's what we call cytoreductive surgery, or the other term is debulking surgery. And follow that with chemotherapy. So the surgery would be to remove the uterus, tubes, and ovaries, the omentum, resect other tumor that may involve bowel surgery, and follow that with either intravenous or intraperitoneal chemotherapy. Okay. There was a land sort of mark description back in the 1970s of survival differences with cytoreductive surgery and how much cytoreduction was performed. This graph here shows you the five-year survival by how much cancer was left behind at primary surgery. So a woman came in with that terrible belly that I showed you a few slides back. She had a big surgery, and it was possible to resect the tumors and the omentum and all the other metastatic spread down to less than a centimeter. And you see here there's quite a significant difference than if more than a centimeter was left behind. And this really started 40 years ago our thinking about surgery as a prime treatment in ovarian cancer. So that Dr. Griffiths back in 1975 published this in the NCI monographs. And then what you have here is a list of the various different types of chemotherapy, starting with melphalan, cytoxan, adriamycin, moving on to cisplatin, which revolutionized the field because of very good response rates. And now we really talk about platinum-sensitive versus platinum-resistant cancer. That's really been since the mid-80s. And then cisplatin was replaced by carboplatin, which had a much better toxicity profile, that was used with cyclophosphamide in the 90s. And then in the mid-90s, paclitaxel joined cisplatin and then carboplatin as really our mainstay. And this has really been for 20 years our standard chemotherapy, and it really hasn't changed much. The things that have changed in the past 5 years have been using chemotherapy upfront to shrink things before surgery. That's been one approach, especially in very, very sick women. And the other is intraperitoneal chemotherapy that I'll talk about in a minute. When recurrence occurs, we define it by these three categories: platinum sensitive, resistant, and refractory. So sensitive is there is a recurrence, but it occurs more than 6 months from completion of the primary chemotherapy. And primary chemotherapy is given after surgery usually, in the most conventional way. You have surgery, you have your 5 to 6 months of chemotherapy, and then following that is when the clock starts ticking. So recurrences that occur over 6 months after that are called platinum sensitive. If they recur within 6 months of completing chemotherapy, that's resistant. And cancers that grow and progress while on the first line chemo that's given after surgery, is called platinum refractory. Very, very poor prognosis. And second thing, aside of revolutionizing the treatment by understanding the importance of surgery and then the importance of platinum and paclitaxel, was this GOG 172 study that showed that giving intraperitoneal cisplatinum with paclitaxel improved survival significantly by 16 months. It's really quite extraordinary. And here's our graphs that you see of the difference. The big issue with intraperitoneal chemotherapy, which makes it and continues to make it a struggle for practitioners to use and for patients to receive, is it's very toxic. And in this primary study, over 60% of the participants could not complete the six treatment cycles of intraperitoneal chemo. Yet having said that, their survival was much improved. Okay, so back in 2006, when the study came out, the NCI recommended that when it's possible to do so, and after optimally reducing a cancer by surgery, intraperitoneal chemotherapy should be offered. Okay, so in terms of side effects to all these sorts of chemotherapy, they're well known: nausea, vomiting, fatigue, myelosuppression, alopecia, hair loss, neuropathy, and GI toxicities. Skin toxicity is more common in second-line chemo such as Doxil than primary chemo. I should also say people can have allergic reactions to platinum and to Taxol. So those are all very standard. Chemotherapy is tremendously costly. I just throw this graph up here to show you that since we started using Taxol, which is a big expense, sort of standard costs of chemo per patient per course is around $20,000. That's per cycle of chemo. Finally, survival rates. This is from the American Cancer Society, but I think it's a nice graph to show you that for stage one, it's not 100%. There's still some recurrences, but it's pretty good, around 80% five-year survival. But when you get to the more common stages, which is a stage three, especially a stage 3C, and a stage four, your survival rates are about 25%. Women die because they lose the ability to eat. The cancer coats their intestines, and they die from pretty much starvation, bowel obstruction, renal failure, and so forth. So, how can we improve upon that? Well, let's first talk about hereditary ovarian cancers. This is your specialty, which you know very well, which makes up at least 10%, maybe more than that, of ovarian cancers. And this here shows you just very simplistically how that's thought of. The majority are sporadic, but in that sliver of the pie, there's genetic mutations, the most common being the BRCA1 followed by 2, and then other gene variants. So our current estimations is about up to even 20% of all ovarian cancer patients have a BRCA gene mutation. Interestingly, we talked about how the high-grade serous tumor makes up about 40% of all ovarian cancers. And in that group, the incidence, the proportion that is actually BRCA gene mutation positive is quite high. It's much higher than all other ovarian cancers, so up to 30%. In terms of those who have the BRCA gene mutation, about up to 44% may not have any previous family history. And because of these numbers, the current recommendation, and I'm talking to the choir here, is to recommend testing for everyone with ovarian cancer at the time of diagnosis, so that as we're taking these women through their therapies, we're thinking about what's available for them that may be useful or add to their treatment because of their BRCA gene mutation status. So in terms of manifestations of hereditary ovarian cancer, the susceptibility genes BRCA1 and 2 are the biggest one. And you have the hereditary ovarian cancer syndrome, which is a subset of the breast ovarian cancer syndrome. A minority will have ovarian cancer who have actually the HNPCC or Lynch syndrome 2. And then there's just a sprinkling of these others that are listed here. The Putz-Yeager being famous for the what's called the sex cord stromal tumors with annular tubules, which is, comes from the inside of the ovary. These are lifetime risks. Again, I think you know this stuff better than me. I like this particular graph because it divides people by under 50 and over 50 and subsets them breast and ovarian cancer. These are two different linkage studies from a decade ago that have that sort of look at the breakdown in risk of ovarian cancer that under 50 and over 50. So you see for the BRCA gene that actually over 50, the risk goes up quite considerably compared to under 50, although it's quite high, significant. And BRCA is a much lower percentage of the ovarian cancer risk here. So in terms of what BRCA does, it's considered a tumor suppressor gene. It, it is important in a repair pathway. The mutation is a dominant inheritance, and the BRCA1 is on the chromosome 17 versus BRCA2 on chromosome 13. And again, here's listed the statistics for lifetime risks in the setting. Now, in terms of BRCA1-related ovarian cancer, when we drill down on this subset, what we see when we look at these tumors is that they have, in general, higher grade, so more rapid growth, more disorganized growth, presenting at advanced stage. There's overexpression of P53. The majority are the serous subtype of the epithelial cancers. And interestingly, this subset has much more chemosensitivity that leads them to probably have a much longer survival, even up to a decade or longer in some cases, starting with advanced stage grade 3 cancer than a woman who is BRCA negative, or of course a woman who has platinum resistant high grade serous cancer. Okay, so if we think about these genes, they're involved in the maintenance of genomic stability, cell cycle checkpoints, the DNA damage response, which we're going to talk about a lot. This particular cartoon kind of sort of shows you the relationship that we kind of think about in BRCA, where you have other sort of types of assaults that can occur, such as gamma radiation and UV light, that can lead to changes and mutations that the BRCA gene, when it's intact, and the BRCA1, BRCA2 gene will repair, preventing the development of a malignant phenotype. Okay, when we think about the molecular pathways and targeted therapies, you know, that brings in this diagram showing you various different targeted therapies, and we're going to touch upon mostly the VEGF ones at the end of the talk in terms of clinical trials with PARP inhibitors, but the PARP inhibitors will impact those who have the BRCA gene mutation. So, what does PARP do? PARP itself is a basically repair system of single-stranded DNA breaks, and will bind to these single-stranded DNA breaks and allow repair. So it's called poly-ADP ribosylation polymerase, and that prevents further damage by preventing it to going into double-stranded breaks. Okay, so here's a diagram of that, where you have in the setting of an inhibition of PARP, the lack of repair of this DNA damage, then an accumulation of these single-stranded breaks, then that goes to double-stranded breaks, and that's where the BRCA mutation comes in terms of repairing those double-stranded breaks. But when that mutation is present, they don't get repaired, and you have what's called a synthetic lethal situation. And so the treatment strategy is to have this sort of double hit of both inhibition of single strand and then double strand. So here's just another diagram of that, where you sort of see the DNA damage, the PARP coming in and repairing that, and then once it's repaired, you sort of move on to normal cell cycle. This shows four different potential scenarios where three of them lead to repair and one of them leads to actual cell death. And so in the normal cell with an intact BRCA gene and PARP, you have both a homologous recombinant repair by the BRCA and the excision repair of the PARP, preventing further damage. In cells that have a BRCA mutation, but still having an intact PARP mechanism, your PARP can repair, and unless there's any other hits to the cell, allow the repair of the DNA. In the same way, when you have conventional chemotherapy that's impacting only part of your pathway, but you have an intact BRCA gene, you may continue to repair and have your cell cycle continue. But when you have both PARP and BRCA X'd out here, as in the panel D, that leads to cell death, and therefore the cancers don't grow. So this is just, again, here where you see no DNA cell repair and cell death. And that's sort of the hope. So PARP has many members, and the ones that have been most studied and are best known is PARP1 and PARP2. The BRCA we talked about has this homologous repair pathway of the double-stranded DNA, and the PARP has the other mechanism of the base excision and then what's called an end-joining pathway to put the single strand back together. So here's just another diagram of that showing the inhibition of PARP leading to lack of repair and then cell death. Okay, so therapeutically, PARP inhibitors, just to summarize, and then we're going to drill down on this some more in terms of clinical trials. In use, we've discovered increased the cytotoxicity of chemotherapeutic agents. One of the core concerns about use of PARP inhibitors over time has been an identification that in some cases there's been a restoration of defective homologous repair, and this is the mechanism of resistance that may be why women who experience ovarian cancer ultimately become platinum resistant. Okay. One other interesting piece that PARP inhibitors do is to trap the actual PARP 1 and 2 gene products on the DNA, and this complex can interfere with DNA replication. So that's a different way that that can work. Okay, so moving on to clinical trials. In terms of background, really started with in vitro studies about 10 years ago. There was a little bit of a hiccup in the meteoric rise of PARP inhibitors when a very important phase 3 breast cancer trial showed a negative effect to PARP inhibitors. However, several phase 1 studies with ovarian cancer were quite promising, and now we have come to a place where in the past year, we are up to phase 3 clinical trials with some of these agents. And what's interesting in these clinical trials is both women with known BRCA1 and 2 gene mutations and BRCA negative patients have been enrolled on these trials. So we're kind of going to go through that a little bit. So we talked about high-grade serous cancers. And what's interesting is that about half of them will have abnormalities of DNA repair, either by germline mutations, BRCA, somatic mutations, changes that occur post-translationally after the BRCA gene product, or other repair molecules that support these mechanisms that all lead to this abnormality in DNA repair. In terms of clinical trials, just quickly to define them, phase 1 are toxicity studies and looking at tolerated doses. Phase 2 are efficacy studies. Do these actually have a tumor response? And then phase 3 studies are comparison studies of different agents, classically the standard of care to the investigational drug. Here are some agents. One has been demoted because, and we actually had a lot of this was under clinical trial investigation here at Mass General, but then turned out not to be a PARP inhibitor, the inupareb. But olaparib, valaparib, rucaparib, niraparib, and the BMN are the current ones that have been investigated. Okay, so just to kind of go through, the first trial was phase one trial that just looked at dosing. It looked at pharmacology. How was it absorbed? In this diagram, the middle panel shows this very rapid peak of absorption and elimination. 60 patients were enrolled in the study, and only a little bit over a third were carriers for the BRCA1 and 2 mutation. They found that the adverse side effects of olaparib were, you know, tolerable, some mood changes, fatigue, low platelets, some sleepiness. Interestingly, in this particular study, they did notice an objective response to the olaparib, but only in the BRCA gene mutation carriers. The next study, looking at a phase two trial of olaparib in a BRCA negative advanced ovarian cancer. This was a very interesting multi-center international trial that looked at two different doses, and the 400 doses milligram is now really the dose that we think about. And they looked at BRCA1 and 2 gene mutation recurrent ovarian cancer. Of the patients enrolled, there was a 33 overall response rate, okay, and that was at the 400 milligrams compared to only a 12.5% response rate at the 100 milligrams, and thought the toxicity was mild. So this was a very exciting study that was presented back 5 years ago that led to the development of other trials. This chart just shows you those preliminary first studies, mostly phase ones that were done in breast and in other solid tumors. Side effects were noted in these studies: neutropenia, nausea, fatigue, low white count, low platelets were the main side effects that were identified from this study. And then moving to ovarian cancer over the past 5 years, this table shows you the various phase two and then phase three studies that looked at olaparib as a single agent, and then a very interesting study of olaparib and then a maintenance therapy. So just to go through it, the first one with Fong was a single agent, and in platinum-sensitive patients, there was a 61% response rate, which is pretty exciting. You'll notice in platinum refractory, it was only 15%. So really, the olaparib does not work in that setting. There was some response rate in the platinum resistance, that is recurrence under 6 months. In the second study, again, there was objective response seen of 41% in the BRCA, the women with the BRCA gene mutations. Okay, and this also was the showed you the dose of 400 milligrams being important. The Lederman study is interesting because what was used was the olaparib followed by a maintenance. Well, the olaparib was randomized either olaparib versus placebo after platinum chemotherapy. And women on olaparib who were BRCA mutation positive compared to those who were BRCA mutation negative, there was a difference in overall progression-free survival of 11 months. So that was quite interesting, just that this was effective in those who were mutation positive, but not negative. Okay. And then these other studies are again further confirmation that there's a response rate, and that in general it's in platinum sensitive and BRCA gene mutations. This second agent, Vilaprib, also has been studied, and this summarizes that response. Again, these are small numbers. This was in breast cancer. So this was sort of the beginning. And what's interesting about these studies was that Vilaprib was combined with chemotherapy. And you see here what chemotherapies they were combined with, temozolide, doxorubicin, and cytoxan, and noted that the response rates were marginal in this group, but that the combination with chemotherapy was tolerated. Now, this summarizes the current trials that are ongoing with the different PARP 1 and 2 inhibitors. The Vilaprib in ovarian cancer, there's an ongoing phase 2 study. There's been multiple studies that have looked at it with chemotherapy. There's a current phase 3 with niraparib. So stay tuned, looking at maintenance versus placebo, similar to that previous olaparib study I showed you. Concurrent phase 2 in this rucaparib, and currently this much newest agent, the BMN, doesn't have any ongoing ovarian cancer trials. Okay. I'm going to finish up by talking about this very interesting phase 2 study that was presented at the spring SGO meeting that randomized women to olaparib alone or olaparib with cedarinib. Okay, so these were women who had recurrent platinum-sensitive high-grade serous cancer. They had measurable disease, and they received one of these two arms. Of note, there was no arm that just had cedarinib in it alone. Now, what is that agent? Well, it's a VEGF anti-angiogenesis agent. So just to quickly stray from PARP and BRCA, at the membrane of the cell are receptors, VEGF receptors, that the most famous one, which is bevacizumab or Avastin, bind to, causing a sort of a switch off of angiogenesis. So cedarinib is one of these anti-angiogenesis tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and this slide just shows you the different variety of these tyrosine kinase inhibitor anti-angiogenesis inhibitors that are currently being investigated. So just as backstory. So anyway, so the PARP inhibitor, olaparib, was put with this anti-angiogenesis inhibitor, and the question was, what happens? So here's the data so far. There were 2 complete responses and 21 partial responses in the olaparib alone arm, compared to 3 and 33. So the overall response rate in arm 2 was 84%, and this was significant. The progression-free survival was quite different, 9 months versus 17 months. And what was very interesting, unlike some of these earlier studies, is when you stratified by mutation status, there was no difference by BRCA mutation status. Now, in terms of side effects, that's very compelling. If you look at the olaparib arm, really minimal, you know, a little fatigue, really not that much more. But look at the side effects in the other arm. Fatigue, diarrhea, hypertension was a biggie, which is, of course, a very big problem with these VEGF inhibitors, these anti-angiogenesis that can cause a hypertension requiring medication. So more to come on where to go with that information. But that study suggests using 2 different targeted therapies has more progression-free survival than just PARP alone. So just to summarize a PARP inhibitor side effect profile, there's bone marrow suppression, there's GI toxicity, and there's fatigue. Those are the big ones. When in the studies that have added chemotherapy, bone marrow suppression can become a dose-limiting problem. And this is a challenge to give concurrent full-dose chemotherapy. So if we summarize all these studies and all the work that's been done over the past 10 years, what we can say is that the PARP inhibitors do show clinical efficacy. The side effect profile is good. That there is an increased overall response rate and progression-free survival rate. In general, they're in BRCA gene mutation positive patients, but probably they are also in patients who have platinum-sensitive disease who may behave like BRCA positive mutation patients, this term called BRCAness that was sort of used a few years ago. So this is probably associated with platinum sensitivity. There is a concern that with the use of this, that the cells will outsmart us and there will be a development of resistance to PARP inhibition with the development of platinum resistance. So this is an ongoing concern that needs to be studied as these clinical trials go forward. Here's my final busy graph, just showing you all the various amazing possible molecular pathways that can be harnessed in the ovarian cancer cell, part of it depending on which mutations the particular type of histology has, the mutations genetically such as the BRCA mutations, and as you see at the bottom, the use of these PARP inhibitors in the setting of a BRCA mutation or a chemoplatinum sensitivity. I'm just going to say that for all the work that we do with women who come in with this advanced life-threatening cancer, the best is prevention. And the best prevention at the current time is to prophylactically remove the ovaries and fallopian tubes in women considered at high risk. And so those would be women with the BRCA1 and 2 gene mutations when they are done with their children, but really thinking about starting to have a very serious conversation about this when these women are in their mid-30s. Also women who have already developed breast cancer but have not yet gotten ovarian cancer, to swoop in there and take out those ovaries or fallopian tubes. There has been a move among the gynecologic oncologists to consider just taking out fallopian tubes and preserving ovaries in younger women, and that's sort of an area of active discussion. Oral contraceptive pills in very young women who are not ready to undergo risk-reducing surgery, and of course, anyone who develops ovarian cancer, to send them to y'all for genetic counseling and evaluation.
Thank you very much, Dr. Goodman, for a wonderful presentation.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was a real privilege to do this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, everyone. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you.
This has been an Ambry Genetics production of Next and Now. To learn more, visit ambrygen.com.